You're listening to WhoRadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.
This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, a proposal to do away with prison sentences of more than 20 years. Mumia Abu-Jamal on the real legacy of Selma, and Barack Obama behaves like Ronald Reagan when it comes to Latin America.
But first, the Patriot Act, which was signed into law during the hysteria following the 9/11 attacks, is up for reauthorization once again this spring. In the 14 years since the Patriot Act was first passed, even some of its authors have questioned its legality and usefulness. And Edward Snowden's revelations about U.S. spying have shocked the world. One would think that the upcoming debate in Congress over the Patriot Act would turn into a knockdown, drag-out fight. We ask Shahid Buttar, Executive Director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee.
I agree with you wholeheartedly, and I think it will be. In prior rounds, there have been several times since the Obama administration took office that the Patriot Act has come up for reauthorization. And unfortunately, in every one of those instances, people in government who had made a lot of noise about mass surveillance were unfortunately very complicit in its extension. I don't think that's going to work anymore. What's really going to happen this year, I think, is going to be a struggle or a reflection between how fearful are the American people, and I think the fear-mongering about ISIS, for instance, is going to play into that, versus how resilient are we and how free are we, basically? How free will we make ourselves? And I think one of the big bright spots here, this will, as a registered Green, it's a little bit odd for me to reflect upon this, but the Republican takeover of Congress actually bodes very well here. Most establishment GOP elected officials, of course, are in bed with intelligence agencies and police departments. It just so happens that there's a substantial minority within the Republican Party that is very skeptical of them. And while Democrats institutionally are supposed to be skeptical of those agencies, they've been largely co-opted by them. So ironically, the emergence of a GOP majority across both houses of Congress with a Democrat in the White House might be the best recipe for congressional independence that's been sorely lacking that we've seen in a long time.
In other words, there will be a real debate within the ranks of the Republican Party over this, even if there isn't one, much of one, in the Democratic Party.
That's right. And I think that the 2016 presidential election and primary is going to be a key venue when this gets sussed out. Rand Paul, the senator from Kentucky, won the CPAC poll, putting him at the head of the Republican field. This is someone who said straight out that the NSA should have a warrant requirement for every time it searches or collects the information or metadata of a domestic person of interest. Basically, that they need to have a warrant to collect your information, which is far, far from the truth at the moment. At the moment, the NSA not only doesn't need a warrant, but when it does get judicial permission, it doesn't even need judicial permission to gather the data that it ends up getting. It needs judicial permission to create these blanket orders that will cover millions of Americans at once without any individual suspicion required to get a warrant. So Rand Paul's position with respect to dragnet surveillance would essentially kill the NSA dragnet. He's been far more outspoken and principled in his defense of constitutional values and rights than have any Democrat. And obviously that's a problem, especially for people who think that Democrats are friendly to civil rights and civil liberties, which they will talk a big game, but at least in the last 15 years, Democrats have been entirely, repeatedly, and remain complicit in the extension of defining hallmarks of authoritarianism in the United States. Not only mass surveillance, you know, arbitrary profiling, according not only to race or ideology, there's obviously been a huge, huge, roiling, frothing controversy about racial profiling, and Democrats have been relatively unhelpful there too. So while it might be a bit of a shock to some listeners to think that Republicans might be the best hope for their constitutional rights, it has gotten so bad in America that the Tea Party is the closest thing we have to constitutional allies against the bipartisan assaults from our government.
How deep a change has the Patriot Act wrought in the civil liberties landscape of America?
It was, quite frankly, massive. The Patriot Act is one of two statutes that enable the NSA dragnet spying regime. The other one is the 2008 Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act amendments. And there's a really interesting story here that speaks to your question. And I'll put it this way. It's changed the law in two ways. Not only has it made the government stronger in terms of being able to violate the privacy of individual Americans, but it's also created and given rise to corruption. And I want to unpack what I mean by that. Let's focus on surveillance first. Before the Patriot Act, there was generally a warrant requirement. Domestic surveillance was very tightly controlled under a set of regulations that Congress had imposed in 1976. That was the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And the reason Congress passed that was because over the course of several years and spending millions of dollars, Congress found that for decades after the Second World War, starting in the 50s through the 60s, into the 70s, and quite frankly into the 80s and well beyond this investigation, Congress found the intelligence agencies, the CIA, the FBI, basically were conducting a war on the American people. And Congress said, this is insane. You can't do this. And they passed a law to stop it. What the Patriot Act did was reverse that. That's just with respect to surveillance. Here's why it's really problematic. So when Congress passed the Patriot Act, it did it without much debate. Many members of Congress, quite frankly, hadn't even read the bill. They didn't know what they were signing. It was pulled off the shelf by law enforcement agencies after the 9/11 attacks. And I want to be clear about this. It had no relationship to the documented intelligence failures that enabled the 9/11 attacks. Just to make that very clear, the 9/11 Commission was explicit that the intelligence community's failures that enabled the 9/11 attacks were not failures of collection, but rather failures of analysis and information sharing. What the Patriot Act did was expand the collection authority, right? It's sort of like saying, okay, our traffic's too bad, so we're going to get extra data tots. You know, it's like it just didn't address the need at all. But what it did do was very dramatically erode First and Fourth Amendment protections that historically had given we the people protections from arbitrary state scrutiny. Among the things that have happened since then, the government has reinterpreted the word collect and search so that they claim that by collecting everything that goes around the internet or the phone system, they're not actually searching anyone, which obviously is ridiculous, flies in the face of two centuries of constitutional precedent. But all that notwithstanding, here's where it gets really bad, and it only comes clear when you look at the arc between the 2001 Patriot Act, the 2005 revelation of how those powers were being abused, the 2008 Biden amendments, and now where we are in 2015. When most of us break the law, we pay consequences. The agencies broke the law in 2001. Remember, the mass surveillance regime of the NSA preceded its statutory authorization. These are programs started illegally, in secret, by the Bush administration. But once people found out in 2005, when a whistleblower revealed that the AT&T building in San Francisco was basically splitting the signal and sending copies of everything that was sent through it to the government, what happened next was 3 years of nothing. And then when the opportunity came to hold the agencies to account and change the law, Congress changed the law not to reinforce its prior commitment and keep the agencies from committing these crimes against the American people, but to say that these crimes against the American people are now legal. And the idea that agencies are rewarded for criminality, that's, I think, the ultimate impact of the Patriot Act, because it created this still ongoing saga of lies, deception, and to put a very simple word on it, corruption has come to pervade the intelligence community. And I think the Patriot Act certainly was not the beginning of that, but it was a very recent apex, and it was certainly the part in the Bush administration when things started to go off the rails.
The Bush administration is associated with the Patriot Act, but the Obama administration has made its own contributions.
That's right. President Obama has reauthorized the Patriot Act several times, always in the relative dead of night. And, you know, there's an interesting story here with respect to his co-optation that goes back before even his entry into the White House. I mentioned that in 2008, Congress changed the law to legalize unconstitutional surveillance. President Obama was a senator at the time, a senator in the middle of a presidential race, who committed publicly to filibustering that law. He said, I will not let this law pass, only then to ultimately not only resign his filibuster, but not only, he didn't even vote against it, he voted for the law that enabled the NSA dragnet. So he's been, unfortunately, in bed with mass surveillance from the very beginning of his presidency. I think a lot of us had a great deal of hope that as a constitutional law professor, supported by the peace and justice movement, you know, it was the peace and justice movement that placed the president in the White House. We got him through the primary with Hillary Clinton in 2008, and he basically abandoned all of the principles that he articulated on the campaign. And as president, he's been much more solicitous of the intelligence agency's concerns than the constitutional concerns that got him in office. And, you know, that's true across issues. Mass surveillance isn't the only one. President Obama, not President Bush, was the president who signed the law authorizing the Pentagon to detain Americans without trial. To his credit, that power has not been used in that way under his administration, but it remains on the books and could be abused horribly, horrifically by his successors. President Obama also has pioneered a new regime of human rights abuses in the form of remote robotic assassination by flying drone. And this is incredibly disturbing because we're talking about, at least in a handful of cases, killing American citizens without trial or charge because either of their speech or their parents' speech. And no one would characterize the legal authority that way, but that's exactly what has happened without any legal recourse or checks and balances or even, quite frankly, transparency into what happened. If you read the memo that the White House leaked trying to justify its use of drone strikes abroad, you know, there are a whole series of limiting criteria. None of it holds any water. And I do fear that for all of the hopes that greeted this administration when it came to Washington 6 years ago, the Obama administration will soon leave Washington in even worse shape than it found it. And that's obviously very disappointing. I think that it will take some sort of very concerted grassroots clamor to force a reckoning on these issues. The 2016 presidential debate might present that clamor, particularly to the extent that the Tea Party influenced Republicans place Rand Paul in the position of winning the GOP presidential nomination, which would, quite frankly, be the biggest thing since Barack Obama and his receipt of the Democratic nomination to challenge these agencies. You know, President Obama was very explicit in his campaign about wanting to restore the balance between security and liberty. He has done anything but that. And America remains waiting, not for a president who can do this, because I don't think a president can. We are waiting for ourselves. We, the people, are the leaders we've been waiting for. And only we, by raising our own voices and building the sort of movement that has historically been inexorable in our country, only then will we regain the rights that have long inspired the world to follow our example.
And of course, the Patriot Act and its various incarnations and associated bills and practices, that's not just a domestic issue. The Snowden revelations told the world that the United States is spying on all the citizens of the planet whose machines and devices it can get access to as well.
That's right. In fact, when I was arrested in the Senate for asking a pointed question of the Director of National Intelligence, I asked exactly that. You know, on what basis do you interpret a law with a targeted surveillance authority to give you the right to wiretap the entire globe? It is extraordinarily offensive, and the rights of people around the world are impacted, and the international community is justifiably outraged. One of the elements here that I thought was somewhat disappointing, there was a great deal of outrage, particularly from Germany and Brazil, when it was disclosed that the leaders of those countries were being spied on by the NSA. And one of the deals, apparently, that was reached was between the White House and their German counterpart saying, okay, we won't spy on your chancellor. What about the other millions of German citizens? And on the one hand, from a legal perspective, the protections or the limits on intelligence agencies to conduct foreign intelligence have historically been much more permissive than the standards under which they collect domestic intelligence. And that makes sense, because what the Church Committee found in its historic investigation in the 1970s is that while the CIA was doing a lot of bad things abroad, assassinating foreign leaders, overturning democratically elected governments, facilitating human rights abuses, running drugs into American cities, lying to U.S. presidents, all of those things the CIA has done for decades and decades and continues to do. But what the Church Committee found in the 70s was that aside from all those foreign abuses, what the Church Committee was really worried about was the way that Americans were being impacted. And there's a reason for that. Basically, the Constitution gives Americans rights. And it gives other people, non-Americans, rights when they're in the U.S., but it doesn't purport to give any rights abroad. There are international human rights declarations that reach those sorts of principles, and agencies or organizations like the UN, like the International Criminal Court, should be concerned about them. But the U.S. Constitution only grants rights within the U.S., which is to say it's the domestic surveillance that is particularly offensive to domestic constitutionalists. I think people who are committed to a free and open internet or people who are internationalists recognize the way in which global mass surveillance violates more than just constitutional rights. Another thing to put on the table here, a lot of people think about these as privacy issues or as transparency issues. I think at the end of the day, what we're talking about here is the freedom of thought and whether or not it will survive the 21st century. Because if you're being watched, you're not actually free, period. Whether you have something to hide or not, you cannot claim to be free if someone or something is watching everything you do and recording it for posterity to potentially use against you in whatever way it might one day see fit. That is the antithesis of freedom. And I think the question, whether in the international context or the domestic one, is for we domestic activists to educate the rest of America about how so fundamental a principle is implicated by this seemingly arcane, impenetrable, inaccessible policy discussion. You know, we're not just talking about mass surveillance and a history of lies and deception to Congress and corruption. We're also talking about a set of tools that could, quite frankly, change the very nature of humanity going forward. In the wrong hands, mass surveillance can be a tool of devastating oppression. And there has never been in the history of humankind a system like this because the technology has never existed. So we absolutely have to get our hands around it and some meaningful transparency and controls now before the next administration, whoever it might be, has a hand to abuse these powers even worse than the current administration.
That was Shahid Buttar of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee in Washington.
This Friday, the Malcolm X and Betty Shabazz Center in New York City will hold a public forum on mass incarceration, police violence, and political imprisonment. The event is sponsored by the journal Socialism and Democracy. Niall Fort, a young activist minister from Newark, New Jersey, will be one of the speakers. He authored an article in the journal's current issue titled Insurgent Intellectual, Mumia Abu-Jamal in the Age of Mass Incarceration. Minister Fort says young people need to learn about the radical black tradition.
What I was trying to do implicitly was to really open up space for, again, folks from this newly emerging movement, or whatever it is, us millennials, to begin to think about our relationship to the state as black bodies, as young black folks, in the context of some of these political prisoners that are being erased from our imagination and our memory nationally and locally, right? Even thinking about folks like Assata Shakur, who was shot by New Jersey State Police. And so as someone living in Newark, I think I try often to talk, not to, but with other young folk about the grand tradition in which we stand, not just of repression, but of resistance. And so I think, again, Mumia and Assata and Russell Schultz and so many folks who the state just doesn't want us to pay attention to. And that's clear and evident by the way in which the state goes about trying to mute them and silence them and ostracize them. I think that alone tells us something about the power of their words, the power of their vision, and the power of their embodied resistance that we can learn something from.
Yes, here we are with what many of us hope will be a new movement, and yet we still have so many political prisoners from the old movement who still remain behind bars.
Yes, we need to begin to create that intergenerational dialogue between those who represent the older movement and those who are representing the newer movement. I think the piece was an attempt to do that. I think this conversation that we're going to have on March 20th is an attempt to do that, though neither the essay and what's going to happen on March 20th is enough. And I think that we need to have really a national call for political education that's intergenerational, and that's critical, and that's radical, that doesn't continue this, what I think is a media myth that there's a generational divide, but really to me it's a political divide. And it's clear to see that when you see who's following Sharpton. They're not all old. There's young folks, some of which I know. Some of them are preachers, right? I'm a young preacher, and I know some of these folks who are waiting to step into that mantle. And so I think that's really important for us to understand that there's really not, at least in my mind, a generational divide as much as it is a political divide. And I think this conversation that we're going to be having on March 20th can hopefully highlight some of that to see how we can learn lessons from each other, see what the young folks can learn from some of the older folks, see what some of the older folks can learn from some of the younger folks, see how technology and new technology has shaped, for better and worse, the way in which we go about organizing. But I think there's many lessons to be learned between generations, and I think that hopefully this conversation can begin something that can be happening all around the country.
That's when Mumia was in the Panther Party, and he was quite young then. He, of course, sold issues every week of the Black Panther Party's newspaper. But there isn't generally access to that kind of political thought for young Black people today.
Yeah, I think one thing that we're dealing with is the erosion of Black institutional life. I mean, we're talking about everything from important institutions in our neighborhood, such as schools and community centers, to what you're talking about is the Black press. And so we're seeing the Black press struggle to continue, right, to make this more radical political thought available to folks. But in a neoliberal moment such as this, with social media at an all-time high, and also with deindustrialization and lack of jobs, I mean, folks just don't got the money, it's really difficult. And so I think we're dealing with so many different forces, and it's really important for us to still figure out ways to get this kind of information out to be able to think with folks in our communities about. And that's up to us. I think that's our struggle. And it's something that, you know, I've been thinking about, I know many of us have been thinking about how we can continue to build institutions in a moment where our institutions in many ways are being wiped out. And the prison industrial complex has become the major institution in which Black folks are subject to, whether we're inside or out. And so I think that's an important question. In many ways, I think we are seeing some. I mean, I know a sister, Ariel Newton, who will be on the panel with me, who's created an online space called Black Millennials. And she writes often, as well as invites other young Black millennials to write. And so there is space. However, again, we're still dealing with so many different forces. Even the attention span of reading, I think, perhaps has gone down as we see the rise of technology and social media, wherein it's really difficult for folks to sit down for long enough and understand the complexity of the issues. And so there's another force. And I just think that, you know, it's really up to us again as to how we're going to deal with and navigate this new space we're in, even though it's the same old problem.
That was Niall Fort, author of a new article on political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal in the journal Socialism and Democracy.
Mumia Abu-Jamal listened from his Pennsylvania prison cell last week to news coverage of the 50th anniversary ceremonies in Selma, Alabama. He filed this report for Prison Radio.
Who can question whether President Barack Obama is a master when it comes to speeches? Such a quality literally put him on the map when he mesmerized a crowd at the 2004 Democratic National Convention. He did it again in Selma, Alabama's 50th anniversary, at the Edmund Pettus Bridge. His central message, no one can doubt that things are better since Selma. No one. His speech, delivered with quiet passion, was a masterwork. And yet, Selma has become sacred in civil rights history, not because of what happened there, but because of what happened thereafter. Public outrage fueled the passage of the Voter Rights Act, the same law recently trimmed by the U.S. Supreme Court. Selma is a vivid example of an evil that still lives with us, that of police immunity for their violence. At Selma, Alabama state troopers and so-called posse men beat people unconscious. They shattered skulls, broke ribs, knocked out teeth, and broke bones. Guess how many of them went to jail? None. Just 4 years after Selma, Chicago cops broke into the apartment of Black Panther leader Fred Hampton and killed him in his sleep. They also killed Captain Mark Clark. Guess how many cops went to jail? Zero. Zip to our present and the Mike Brown case. No criminal trial, state or federal. Too hard, say federal prosecutors. On May 13th, 1985, cops drop bombs from a helicopter and shoot and burn 11 men, women, and children to death, and also destroy several city blocks. In that case, 20 years after Selma, how many cops went to jail? You know, none. Obama could have addressed police immunity, but that would have shattered his "we're all better" speech. What radicalized and motivated Ferguson was a long train of police impunity and immunity after violence against the community. They had seen it too many times. So Selma is closer than we think. It continues to trouble us today.
That was Mumia Abu-Jamal speaking from Frackville State Prison in Pennsylvania.
No one should be sentenced to more than 20 years in prison, no matter what the crime, according to Mark Maurer, the executive director of the Sentencing Project in Washington. Maurer testified last week on Capitol Hill before a task force on prison reform. He says a 20-year limit on sentencing may sound radical to lots of Americans, but it's much closer to the norm in Europe.
Well, exactly. And, you know, if you look at the United States compared to other industrialized nations, we lock up our citizens at 5 to 10 times the rate as those other nations. And, you know, differences in crime rates explain part of that, but only part. Most of it is that we are just tougher in our sentences than other countries. We have 3,000 people on death row in the U.S. and 160,000 people serving life sentences. That's one of every 9 people in prison. A number of countries in Europe have found life sentences to be unconstitutional, and those that still maintain it generally have a few dozen people, not tens of thousands, serving those kinds of terms.
Has it always been the case that the United States has handed down such draconian sentences compared to other places?
Well, we've had a higher rate of incarceration than most democratic nations for some time, but the scale of that disparity has really risen dramatically over the last several decades, the so-called tough on crime years through mandatory sentencing, 3 strikes and you're out, cutbacks on parole release. Policymakers have adopted, you know, a range of policies and practices designed to both send more people to prison and keep them there for longer periods of time. And unfortunately, from my perspective, it's been very successful, and it's given us a world record prison population. So we really are distinguished in that area, and many other nations, you know, look at our policies, you know, with a great deal of shock at what we've done in this country.
And in fact, we have people serving life sentences who committed the offenses when they were juveniles.
Well, exactly. You know, there are today about 2,500 individuals serving life without the possibility of parole for crime committed when they're under the age of 18. Research looking at this around the world has found there's not a single identified case in any other country of a juvenile serving such a sentence. So we either have the worst kids in the whole world, or we have the harshest policies. And unfortunately, I think it's the policy. There have been 2 decisions by the Supreme Court in recent years that have cut back the possibility of life without parole sentences for juveniles. But nonetheless, it still remains a very overwhelming problem.
Now, you gave us data on the number of people serving life sentences and those on death row, but what, at least ballpark figure, would you have on folks who are serving 20 years and more?
Well, you know, unfortunately, there's no means of getting that data. The Justice Department doesn't compile in any comprehensive way, but, you know, just anecdotally from everything we hear of sentencing practices and individual cases, it's quite likely that there are tens of thousands of people serving 20, 30, 40 years in prison or so. We've seen even some states now establishing what they're calling geriatric prisons, essentially prisons for old people, and you see pictures of people going down the hall in wheelchairs and, you know, in very large infirmary structures, things like that. So it's really become a growth industry of sorts in recent decades.
So the proposal is to have an upper limit of no more than 20 years, except in exceptional circumstances. What would be exceptional circumstances?
Well, one could argue that there could be some consideration of a public safety risk that would be determined after a period of 20 years. You know, it's notable that one example, if you look at the country of Norway, the upper limit on sentences there is 21 years in prison, no matter the crime. And you may recall several years ago when that sort of crazed person went to an island just off of Oslo and killed about 70, mostly teenagers and a few other people, you know, with an automatic weapon. And horrendous as that was, he sentenced to the maximum 21 years, and then there was a provision for civil confinement following that if it's determined that he's still a threat at that point. So there are ways that, you know, one could set up a system to make that determination, but the one thing we do know is that on the day a person is sentenced, no matter how heinous their crime may have been, no one knows what that person will be like in 10 or 20 years. People have a great capacity for change, and that's why we need to look at the individual, not just the crime that they've been convicted of.
Well, there seems to have been a political change, especially on the right. There's lots of talk about a new convergence of opinion on mass incarceration on the left and the right. What's the basis for that?
Well, it's been very intriguing in recent years. We have people like Newt Gingrich co-sponsoring the event this month that's calling for a 50% reduction in the number of people in prison. You know, I think if one is a true conservative and they doesn't like big government, well, big prisons are certainly a big part of big government. You know, if one is a true conservative and cares about how government funds are spent, the money we've poured into prisons has not been a very good investment in public safety. And I think also the, you know, overwhelming influence of the drug war strikes many people as excessive, as the federal government getting into an area that's much better handled locally, often through treatment and prevention rather than criminal justice. So I think it's a confluence of factors coming together, but it's been encouraging to see a sort of growing bipartisan consensus that there are far too many people in prison and we need to substantially reduce those numbers and shift our public safety focus.
Lots of black folks think that the fact that methamphetamines have made such a deep impact in middle America, that means white America, that that has a lot to do with the new look at incarceration.
Well, it may. It's hard to tease that out, although, to be fair, there are many places there are mandatory penalties that go along with methamphetamine offenses as well, and those are generally applied to whites and Latinos and only rarely to African Americans. So I think it's a confluence of things coming together. You know, it's hard to psychoanalyze why conservatives are interested in this as much as it is liberals as well. And, you know, notably, for many years, there was a bipartisan consensus on criminal justice, but it was a bipartisan tough-on-crime movement, Democrats and Republicans alike, with a few notable exceptions. So both political parties, I think, bear a good deal of blame for the situation we're in today, and it's encouraging that, you know, enough of them seem to be reconsidering what those years brought us and what direction we should go now.
Yes. Do you think 20 years ago, an official task force like the Colson Task Force would be seriously considering a proposal like this?
No. And, you know, 20 years ago, 1994, we had the historic federal crime bill promoted by President Bill Clinton, obviously a Democrat. And that was a $30 billion piece of legislation that was heavily focused on expanding incarceration and funding for law enforcement, with just a relative handful of funds for any kind of prevention work. And it led to an expanded prison system. It led to tougher sentencing policies, expanded the use of the federal death penalty, and got an overwhelming vote in Congress from both Democrats and Republicans at the time.
Mark Maurer of the Sentencing Project in Washington.
President Obama recently signed an executive order describing Venezuela as an extraordinary threat to the national security of the United States. Apologists for the president claim he only used the apocalyptic language for technical reasons so that he could legally impose sanctions on Venezuela. But Professor Miguel Tinker Salas doesn't think so.
I think more importantly is that the countries of Latin America do not consider it to be a pro forma technical measure. In fact, we see the very clear example of this going back to December of 2014 when Obama first announced normalizing relations with Cuba. He immediately turned to sanctions on Venezuela on the eve of the fact that the Republican-controlled House had actually also promoted sanctions. So it's very clear that this is a concerted policy of trying to isolate Venezuela from Latin America, from U.S. public opinion, and to continue a policy that was begun by Bush to inoculate Latin America from the contagion that Venezuela represents in terms of social and political change.
Well, the United States found out after all these decades that its effort to isolate Cuba resulted only in the United States being further isolated from Latin America. Are they going to learn that lesson much more quickly in this case with Venezuela?
Well, they seem not to, because on the one hand, the U.S. acknowledges, and Obama himself acknowledged, that sanctions did not work against Cuba. And in fact, as you highlight, in the 2012 Summit of the Americas that took place in Cartagena, Colombia, Obama was completely isolated on the question of Cuba and on the question of drug policy, with his own allies, countries like Colombia, saying that there has to be a different approach on the drug issue. So now we turn around, and we're going to have the Summit of the Americas in Panama on April 10th and 11th, and once again, the U.S. will find itself isolated. So that what it's doing for is fishing for fissures. They've had a concerted effort to isolate Venezuela and to undermine the changes taking place in Latin America with the founding of the Union of South America, the CELAC, the Community of Latin American and Caribbean Nations. So they're really pushing the Trans-Pacific Alliance, and they're trying to push this sort of NAFTA on steroid approach, which includes the countries that already have free trade agreements with the U.S. So in fact, they're looking for fissures. They're looking to see if they could find divisions and splits, and they're playing essentially the same kind of imperial card that they've played in the past.
What do you think the intended effect of the U.S. announcement will be within Venezuela itself, the impact that it'll have among the opposition?
Well, I think that the opposition finds itself in an awkward position right now because, on the one hand, they have been organizing and actively promoting the ouster of Maduro. We've seen a very undemocratic process that began in February and March of 2014 continue through the entire year and into this year. But now they find themselves, in many ways, trying to remove themselves from the Obama administration's position because, in many ways, the U.S. has essentially made themselves the central issue, internal Venezuelan politics. They have allowed themselves to become, and they have promoted themselves as the central issue in terms of intervention in Venezuela, and they're being criticized by the Maduro government in Venezuela, and they're being criticized by Latin American leaders, and they're being criticized in Venezuela as well. So in some ways, it's very clear that they were also aiming to find fissures also within the military, because by targeting military individuals in terms of sanctions, they're also testing the waters to see if there are divisions in the military, so that there's multiple approaches in the strategy.
If the U.S. were to undertake direct military intervention in Venezuela, what do you envision the reaction would be Latin America-wide?
I think we would return to what we saw in Central America, and I think that there would be a conflagration throughout Northern South America and in the Caribbean. I think that this would be one of the most destabilizing events in the region's history. We would see a repeat of Libya, where you have essentially a country that the U.S. dismantled and now is ungovernable, and while they can still exploit the oil. I think that that would be exactly what you would find in Venezuela. Venezuela would become largely ungovernable, as would many of the countries of the northern region. So there should be some real, real deep thinking here, and there should be strong protests here before that action ever happened.
What do you think about a critique from the left that says that the Venezuelan government should have cracked down on these insurrectionist opposition folks when it was at the height of its popularity, when Chavez was alive?
Well, I think the Venezuelan process has been an open democratic process, legitimated every time through the electoral system. There's been 19 different elections in Venezuela, and that's what's given legitimacy to the very process that has taken power in Venezuela. So I think that to repress in any way, shape, or form would actually fuel greater discontent and, in fact, would be contrary to the very principles that the Chavista movement has developed from its very inception. So I think that they would be counterproductive. But I think it's very clear in how the U.S. responds to protests in Venezuela and how it responds to protests protest anywhere else, because we had 43 people killed in February and March of 2014 in protests. They were on both sides of the political spectrum, in which police and military were targeted. Yet in Mexico, where there's 43 students disappeared by the state, there is no condemnation, no criticism. In Venezuela, there is instead sanctions. So we see a duplicitous role on the part of the U.S. on this matter.
Yes, and in Mexico, we see casualties of this ongoing war amounting to 50,000 and more people on a scale of a civil war, and with all of the attendant human rights abuses.
In fact, Mexico faces a real human rights crisis. I mean, yesterday, a mayor running for candidate of mayor in the state of Guerrero was decapitated. A mayor running for candidate in Tamaulipas was shot at. And there's not a peep out of the State Department. In Venezuela, a student was unfortunately killed a few weeks ago. The same day, a school teacher, a union president, was shot and killed in Acapulco. John Kerry criticized Venezuela, said nothing about their ally in Mexico. And in Mexico, the number of dead is now reaching almost 100,000, with 40,000 disappeared. And we talk about immigrants, and we don't realize that those immigrants coming to the U.S. are also victims of that war in Mexico. So this means 15 million people expelled from their country as a result of these economic and political and military policies. And yet the U.S. simply says nothing about Mexico. In fact, is a supporter of Mexico, providing the Mexican military with billions of dollars of funding and the Mexican state with money as well. So therefore, the U.S. is implicated in the human rights crisis in Mexico.
And right next door, we have Colombia, the United States' closest ally in South America, where 6 million people have been displaced for political reasons.
At one time, there were more displaced people in Colombia than there was in Iraq, and that's the sad reality of the U.S.'s militarization of the drug conflict in Colombia. And again, Colombia in that context has been an exporter now of U.S. security, because Plan Colombia became Plan Mexico. And in fact, the military advisors, General Naranjo, which was in charge of the military operations in Colombia, was an advisor to the Mexican military and to the Mexican president. So Colombia becomes, as a U.S. intermediary, becomes an exporter of the U.S. military model, of the state's repression and of military repression in that same sort of fashion. And that model is exportable throughout the region as a result of the U.S. policy there.
And in Honduras, under President Obama's watch, we have a military coup that seems to have begun at a U.S. Air Force base.
And it was under President Obama and under Secretary Hillary Clinton, who actually lobbied Latin American leaders to endorse the coup and not bring Manuel Zelaya back to power. So it's very important to remember what happened in Honduras. So while Obama was sitting in Trinidad at the Summit of the Americas, shaking hands with Hugo Chavez and Lula and other Latin American leaders, his own State Department and his own allies were in fact opening and greenlighting a coup in Honduras. We saw that a year later, when in fact that coup takes place. The U.S. tries to block it in the OAS. The U.S. tries to ensure that other Latin American leaders will not oppose it. You had the fallout with Brazil, because Brazil gave Zelaya a refuge in their embassy. And the reality is that the coup in Honduras could not have happened had the U.S. not greenlighted that coup. And the same thing in Paraguay with Mr. Lugo, a president who was also deposed 2 years later.
And now we have most of the rest of the Americas essentially abandoning the OAS as being a vehicle for U.S. policy and setting up CELAC.
Well, in fact, we have the construction of the Community of Latin American and Caribbean Nations. We have the Union of South American Nations, UNASUR. We have ALBA, the Bolivian Alliance. And even in the OAS, last March, when the U.S. attempted to get the OAS to condemn Venezuela, impose sanctions, and send a delegation to Venezuela, the OAS voted not to. The U.S. was isolated. It was the U.S. and Canada, in fact, were the essential votes in that process. So even in terms of the OAS, the U.S. has lost its hegemony. And you have, therefore, Cuban-American politicians suggesting that the U.S. should stop funding the OAS because they can no longer control it. That's how much politics has changed in Latin America in the last 15 years.
The corporate media doesn't give us much of a knowledge base about what are the roots of the opposition to the present government in Venezuela. But those who have observed the country understand that there is a definite racial dimension to the conflict there.
there is a very dramatic racial dimension. The reality is that Venezuela historically has had racist policies towards its people of color within Venezuela. The national mythology of café con leche, coffee with milk, serves to obscure the fact that Venezuela has been a racially hierarchical society, one in which people of African descent and indigenous descent have been marginalized, have been discriminated. Obviously, the argument in Venezuela is that racism doesn't exist because we have miscegenation, we have racial mixing, but in fact, Venezuela is no different than Brazil and is no different than any other country in the Caribbean where that racist dynamic exists and where a white privilege hierarchy prevails and where that model retains its privilege. And part of the issues that are informing the current opposition has been the loss of those privileges and the fact that Hugo Chavez welcomed his African heritage, his indigenous heritage, and welcomed and in fact has been changing the discourse in the country and changed the discourse in the country in which you saw the empowerment of Afro-Venezuelans and indigenous Venezuelans and others with institutional rights and not simply executive orders.
And we see that racial aspect playing out in terms of where the centers of the opposition are.
If you look at the centers of opposition in Venezuela, in Caracas and eastern Venezuela, these are largely upper-class, middle-class, white neighborhoods, or even people that are mixed-race, mestizo. That's not to say that you don't have mixed-race opposition right-wing people in Venezuela. You do, because they are part of that dominant discourse of privilege that has existed in that society, as we've seen elsewhere in the Caribbean. We saw it in Haiti. We saw it in Dominican Republic, etc. So that even within that discourse, there's privilege, and that privilege they seek to maintain through their opposition to the current government.
That was Professor Miguel Tinker Salas at Pomona College in Claremont, California.
Mark Weisbrot is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research and a longtime observer of Latin American affairs. Weisbrot says President Obama is behaving towards Venezuela much like President Ronald Reagan treated Nicaragua back when Reagan financed a proxy war against that country in the 1980s. Back then, Reagan claimed that Nicaragua posed a threat to the citizens of Harlingen, Texas, and other towns along the southern U.S. border.
Yes, 2 days' drive from Harlingen, Texas, is what he said, trying to scare people and justify the intervention there much more than Obama would do today, for example, with Venezuela, where he's kind of denying intervening altogether. What's missing from most of the news reporting is how much the hemisphere really resents this and how much the United States is isolated in the Americas. The Times had actually a great quote in there from President Correa of Ecuador. He said, "This must be a joke in bad taste," referring to the sanctions, "that reminds us of the darkest hours of our America, when we received invasions and dictatorships imposed by the imperialists. Can't they understand that Latin America has changed?" And I thought that was really eloquent and very unusual to see this in the New York Times, because, again, this view, this point of view, which is shared by really almost all the governments in the Americas, is never seen. And it's really true. The foreign policy establishment here, which of course includes most of the major media, they really don't have this idea. They don't notice that the hemisphere has changed drastically in the last 15 years and is really independent, truly independent for the first time in 150 years of the United States. It's been a sea change. And of course, that's part of the reason why the United States has been trying to get rid of the Venezuelan government for most of the last 15 years, because they played a major role and continue to play a major role in this process.
Yes, one could argue that the very existence of CELAC, the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States, which includes everybody in the Western Hemisphere except Canada and the United States, that this is a result of the extreme isolation of the United States and its junior partner, Canada.
Yeah, it's a pretty good clue when all the countries in the hemisphere get together and form a new organization parallel to the Organization of American States, and it includes everybody but the U.S. and Canada. And the main reason they did that was because when the military overthrew the government of Honduras in 2009, the United States used its influence within the OAS to block the other countries in the hemisphere from trying to fight harder to restore the democratically elected president. And that was kind of a turning point, and it was also the event that, more than anything, convinced the rest of the hemisphere that this new president, who they really liked at first and was hoping would be different, President Obama, was not going to be different on policy towards Latin America.
And it may have been the event that led to the United States trying to seek normalization of relations with Cuba. But then they turn around and declare that Venezuela represents a threat to U.S. national security.
Yeah, it is ironic. And a lot of people have been asking about that. I've done a lot of press interviews since these sanctions were imposed. People want to know, why is he doing this? Because it does contradict or appear to contradict what they just did with Cuba. But I think, first of all, I mean, this is a difficult question to answer because you have 16 intelligence agencies, the Pentagon, the State Department, and the White House, and they're all involved. And so if you even ask people high up in the government, they're not going to necessarily know the answer to this. So I can't claim to know the answer definitively. But what you can see, first of all, is that the opening to Cuba, it's kind of a legacy thing for President Obama. You know, this, because it's very symbolically charged, this is a policy that's failed for more than a half a century, and really most of the entire elite in this country, including the corporations and everybody who's anybody in our ruling class, has wanted to get rid of this embargo since the 90s and even before. So it's not controversial there. I think for a variety of reasons, institutional and political reasons, including the Florida Cuban exiles and their lobby and money and influence, it hasn't happened. And of course it still hasn't happened, you know, because they're controlling the Congress right now and they got a long way to go before that becomes a reality. But I think one thing that you can see is that the reason it has such widespread support among the elite is because there's money to be made there, markets to be opened, real estate that could become valuable, and all kinds of things that are enticing to rich people in the United States. But also, even politically, I think the political actors in the foreign policy establishment see this opening of relations as a more effective way of challenging the Cuban government and ultimately getting rid of that one too. And that is really their overall goal. They still have a Cold War strategy, which means they see the Americas like they see the world. It's a chess game. You want to get rid of all the people who don't follow your foreign policy strategy any place you have an opportunity. That's why they got rid of the government of Honduras, because they could. That's why they were involved in the coup in Venezuela in 2002. They saw an opportunity there. And I think that's part of what you're seeing right here is the Obama administration, which is divided on this. I mean, there's no doubt about it. There's plenty of people within these various foreign policy-making institutions in the U.S. who see this move as really stupid. They see that it's probably going to hurt the people they like within Venezuela. In fact, the opposition coalition put out a statement yesterday saying, we don't like the sanctions, it's going to hurt us. So why are they doing it? I think, if I had to guess, I would say that aside from the, you know, the far right, which has influenced Obama's policy considerably at key junctures when he did try to make moves, for example, to restore ambassadorial relations with Venezuela, and they sabotaged it and were able to prevent it, you've got this faction within the administration that doesn't really want to have normalized relations with Venezuela. And so, you know, this summer, the administration was moving in that direction when they accepted the Venezuelan chargé d'affaires. In other words, the second, its replacement for an ambassador. When you don't have an ambassador, they exchange that. And, of course, there would be eventually, if you didn't completely sabotage this relationship, there would be a move to have ambassadorial relations again. It probably wouldn't happen under the Republican Congress, but it could happen in the beginning of 2017. And that's what they're trying to prevent. That's, I think, the faction within the administration and that whole foreign policy making complex that really doesn't want to normalize Venezuelan relations because they don't want to legitimize the government. It's part of a destabilization strategy. They wanted to make sure that they could push back U.S.-Venezuelan relations as far as they could. And that's what they did with these sanctions. And they're willing to pay the price that the whole hemisphere hates them for it.
Well, if this is a chess game, as you describe, it seems to have lots of people playing on the U.S. administration side, but the U.S. doesn't have many allies in Latin America besides Colombia and Honduras. Doesn't that leave the United States with few moves to play other than military intervention or an ongoing subversion against Venezuela?
Well, you know, Colombia is not really on their side either anymore since Santos was elected. In fact, at the last Summit of the Americas, and there's going to be another one in April, he was one of the people who stated there's not going to be another Summit of the Americas without Cuba. So this is what's happened is the left governments have changed the norms and institutions of hemispheric relations so much that even non-left governments who formerly were willing to do most of what the U.S. asked them to do, now you have a whole different situation. So, yeah, I think it does leave them. They are certainly more isolated than even Bush was among the governments of Latin America. But they have the media, which is very powerful, you know, because like all the things I'm telling you about what the governments think and what they act upon, is very different from what most of the population believes, because the Latin American press is even worse than the U.S. press on these issues. And so that's very important. They have economic power, so they can help. And, of course, they have covert operations as well. So they can try to destabilize this government. But it's true, they won't get much in terms of anybody taking their side.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.
United We Fight. The African Internationalist Conference on African Women is being sponsored by the African People's Socialist Party.
March 21st and 22nd at the Stewart Center, 821 Vernon Street, Northeast in Washington, D.C.
Get involved and register now for issues African women face. Political and social oppression, economic exploitation,
underemployment, social immobility.
End to the political and social oppression, bringing African women into political life.
Register now at www.apspuhuru.org/AI Women's Conference
or call 202-642-4672. That is 202-642-4672.
For the Conference on African Women, Saturday and Sunday, March 21st and 22nd in Washington, D.C. www.apspuhuru.org/AI Women's Conference.
Everybody over there!
Get on up!
Everybody right there!
Get into it!
Everybody right there!
Get
get involved.
And join the struggle to win the war of ideas and the struggle for African liberation. We are seeking volunteer activists to join our Uhuru Radio team as producers, hosts, and engineers. You can become an official distributor of the Burning Spear newspaper, the longest Black Power publication since the 1960s. Are you a copy editor or proof editor? We can use your expertise. Are you a video editor? We can see you as part of our progressive team. Volunteering means giving poor and oppressed people worldwide access to the voice of the international African working class. Call us at 727-824-5700. That's 727-824-5700 and get involved. You can donate meaningfully and become a sustaining paying member by logging on to uhurunews.com or again, call 727-824-5700. That's 727-824-5700. Get up, get into it, get involved.
Everybody, you!